Thrive, Chapter 4. Overcoming fear of failure and no dumb affirmations allowed. Some things are too good to be true and some things are too true to be good. We fail to thrive not because we fail, but because we don't fail. If you're not failing, you're not trying. And we'll see a bit later, failure is seldom fatal. It's not the failure that thwarts our success, it's the fear of failure. In my son's vernacular, as a five-year-old, I'm not afraid of the dark, I'm afraid of what might be in the dark. My son got over that before he was 10. Many of you are still burdened by it. Subheading, if it looks too good to be true, let someone else try it first. While consulting with Hewlett-Packard for 10 years, it occurred to me that they were seldom first into a market, but rather a strong second, once they had evaluated what was happening. But they didn't merely follow, they innovated from there. Similarly, Steve Jobs has consistently proclaimed that Apple jumps on the next big thing. They don't create the next big thing, but they try to recombine and reconfigure technologies to exploit and dominate the next big thing. Hence, the amazing success of the iPod and iPhone, and now perhaps the iPad, who knows? The iPhone is an example of what I call REV, by the way, R-E-V, reciprocating exponential value. The more iPhones, the more apps become valuable. The more apps, the more the iPhone becomes valuable. The more valuable the apps, the more people become engaged. Well, you get the idea. Reciprocating exponential value. There is a maturity of judgment and singularity of purpose, and understanding that it's often better to allow someone else to take the first bungee jump, or wear the first midi skirt, or ride the first mechanical bull. The hackneyed inquiry, of course, is who had the courage to eat the first oyster. There's plenty of time to get in the game afterwards, and the first entry rarely dominates. Just consider Osborne Computer, or Motorola cell phones, or Zenith televisions. Your patience would have to be high with Bernie Madoff and the Ponzi scheme crews, but eventually you would have seen the early investors lose everything. The only place this doesn't hold true, by the way, is in classic pyramid schemes, today euphemistically called multi-level marketing, but no less corrupt, unethical, and reprehensible. When you make money only through bringing in new members and sell nothing in volume of discernible value, the numbers to sustain income for third and fourth generation investors soon swell to exponential zeros. In one of my earlier books, I calculated by the 12th level of a pyramid scheme, one would require the population of Cincinnati to repay investors at that stage. Anyway, back to basics. Early adapters, so completely revered, often get creamed. Thriving personally isn't about being first, it's about being happy. This is a rough guess. I have zero empirical evidence, but you may relate to the belief that of all things one can own, timeshares represent the most grievously unhappy or uninvolved percentage of consumers. People make impulse decisions about them while on vacation and offered a pitiful assortment of junk and bad food to take the tour. Or they follow the inflated advice of others who want to talk themselves into having made a good investment that they've actually come to despise. Now, you may have a terrific time in your timeshare arrangements, or you may be trying to salve your ego. But this is an example of an area where you're better off waiting, testing someone else's property, getting multiple stories, and generally biding your time. These things seem too good to be true, and too often they are, because, one, it's much tougher to trade weeks elsewhere than the salespeople claim, so your choices are limited. Two, you're confined to this vacation lifestyle and often must pass up more interesting or varied possibilities. Three, you're confined for a long period of time with very little chance of escaping from the contract or selling it. Four, the sheer vanilla of the surroundings and the neighbors becomes boring. I've met a great many people who merely allow their weeks to lapse, give them to other family members, or trade them in for frequent flyer miles where allowed. That's what my wife and I have come to do. The DeLorean sports car was a horrible idea, and I'd recommend a wait-and-see game with the Tesla, the electronic sports car, that accelerates very fast, but it's uncomfortable, it lacks power steering, has a mediocre 250-mile cruising range that, when exhausted, is not likely to be near the kind of recharging apparatus required to bring the beast back to life. Do people really want a sports car that goes whoosh? Low-flush, environmentally friendly toilets were quite popular and being installed frequently until it was discovered that they required two or three flushes, using more water than a normal toilet, to accomplish what toilets were, well, created to do. It's generally a good idea not to be first to last, but somewhere within close proximity to the front. I remember when they conducted those infuriating, symbolic, random searches at the airports right at the airline gate. The search team had a quota, so they would always pull over the first person to board in first class, usually me. to make sure they began hitting their numbers, and they always nailed the last few people in coach to board because they were usually behind their quota. But the third person to board was virtually never searched. This is based on painful trial and error. And so if you were a terrorist, being third was a good bet. You needn't be the first to host a party, organize the trip, perform the intervention, try the host's molasses brulee, or study the loot. It's okay to ask around, observe, and merely participate. Yes, I know someone has to pick up the old baton, but someone has to take the initiative, but it needn't always be you. But I'm saying it that it needn't always be you. If you insist, don't expect sympathy from me. The person in front tends to get the insects in the face. Subhead, they can hit you, they can knock you down, and they can hurt you. Nothing drives me crazier than speakers spouting aphorisms amidst motivational mudslides. Okay, Dr. Phil McGraw, the unlicensed hypocrite, drives me crazier, but I'm using hyperbole here. There's a guy in the National Speakers Association, in the Professional Speaking Hall of Fame, of which I am a member, and to quote Groucho Marx, who'd want to belong to a club where they'd have me as a member, who's one of the very few remaining totally motivational speakers. And thank the gods about that. My position is that any speaker had better be motivational if he or she expects the audience to stay in the seats. But we'd better have some solid content and not just the gelatinous pap of pure motivation. Anyway, he has an unhappy habit of actually proclaiming things such as they can hit you, but they can't knock you down. Well, what on earth does that mean? I mean, really? Of course they can knock you down. They can actually hurt you. Hell, they can knock you out and send you to intensive care. Isn't the point not to be hit? Arguing with insipid aphorisms is akin to playing tennis with an unstrung racket. But my point obtains. Empty-headed apothegms simply create empty efforts. One of the most bizarre documents to employ the English language that I've seen during the latter part of my lifetime is the Successories Catalog, which purports to provide positive sayings and invigorating mantras for self-improvement. Quote, only the lead dog ever sees a change of scenery, unquote, would be representative, though I honestly don't know where that one came from. It might have been passed on by our Siberian husky somewhere in the mid-90s. We seem to be reliving the old Southern Baptist tent revivals, although at least those were intended to bring people closer to God. These days, we seem intent on bringing people closer to an egalitarian mediocrity. Let me pose a few politically incorrect observations. First, we're not all good at everything that we try. We should be judicious in that regard and not be overly disappointed. Next, one can be good at something and have low self-worth or be poor at something and yet feel highly worthy. The point is to always have high self-worth while recognizing that you're not always good at everything. I can't dance, for example, though I can rock gently with a woman in my arms. I'm a practicing heterosexual. Next, we all deserve an equal starting line and level playing field, but not an equal finish line. Talent, skill, and hard work should always out. Next, society, the very one that you and I live within, is carried forward most efficiently by promoting the best and the brightest and not by giving everyone, regardless of talent, their turn. As legendary Kentucky basketball coach Adolf Rupp inquired, if winning isn't important, why does anyone bother to keep score? By the way, inevitably, there are now anti-successories accessories, which might proclaim, for example, quote, give it 110% effort when you don't have the talent to honestly compete and must claim something, unquote. Finally, vapid bromides and mantras don't create better performance or better English. They tend to provide pseudo-skills, enabling the low road passage. You don't have to try harder. You can simply kid yourself through emotionally manipulative phraseology. If you choose to engage in positive self-talk or power language, that's a fine pursuit, and there are honest-to-goodness scientists who have made a career of finding out how best to do so. To name just one, Google Martin Seligman and his books, like Learned Optimism. They're good stuff. You can't thrive, though, tentatively. That is, you can't frame every statement as an interrogative. Read this without conviction and end it with your voice increasing in pitch. It goes like this. We should go on vacation? It will sound like, should we go on vacation? This is called up-talking, and women are more guilty of it than men, though quite a few men do it as well. Nor do you thrive by second-guessing yourself and storing slogans in your cheeks like a chipmunk trotting on hot coals. Don't you love speakers who ask you to raise your hand every 9 seconds? How many of you have had chicken fried steak and consider that audience participation that they do so? Or the trainers who give you a workbook and ask you to fill in the blanks? I need to blank my teeth after every meal. The acceptable entry there is, by the way, remove. Or the person at the dinner party who responds to someone's admission that they have a crack habit, illegitimate child, attraction to their toaster or dandruff with, it's always darkest before the dawn, or it's not what happens to you, it's what you do about it. Yeah, okay, then at least tell me what I should specifically do about that toaster fetish. If you want someone to follow you, find out what's in their self-interest and then exemplify the behavior that you expect them to emulate. If you want to carve out a new route for yourself, examine your own best self-interest and find someone who exemplifies it so they can be your avatar. Here's a brief digression. I work for a major hospital CEO on a number of projects, and every available wall of his facility was a plaque with our basic values on it, and the fourth value down of eight was, we respect our people. It's always the fourth one down. These plaques are pre-printed somewhere in Latvia. Right in front of these ubiquitous propaganda plaques, you could see hospital managers ruthlessly beating up people, emotionally and professionally. The CEO, and I am not making this up, said to me one day, I can't understand the morale problem we have here. We proclaim our beliefs in public all over the place. Bill, I asked him, do you really think people believe what they read on the walls or what they see in the halls? If your example is an empty-headed motivational speaker, you're likely to become one yourself. If your model is a pragmatic, high-content speaker, then you'll be prone to walk and talk in that direction. As I've mentioned earlier, for every motto and saying, there's an equal and opposite motto and saying. Haste makes waste, and then there's get there firstest with the mostest. Call it Allen's fifth law of mantra dynamics. Adages and apothems have a calming effect because they attempt to alleviate our necessity to think, to apply discipline, to take accountability. These are verbal placebos, and you no more thrive after them than you would lose the flu after a medical placebo. Yeah, you don't have to convince me that psychology and beliefs play a strong role in behavior, ergo my recommendation about positive feedback, but give your id some credit. If you listen to the great stories, songs, and even poetry, you'll find tremendous creativity and innovation. The substance seldom mindlessly repeats. Instead, the present builds upon the past and urging us to action. I mean, listen to this. She gets too hungry for dinner at 8. She loves the theater but never comes late. She'd never bother with people she'd hate. That's why the lady is a tramp. That's Rodgers and Hart from Babes in Arms in 1937. It's melodic. It makes sense. It's creative. It just sort of beats the hell out of something like, she's her own person and can make, and they can't make her anyone else. They can knock you down and they can knock you out, especially if you're distracted by loony sayings that make no sense and belong in fortune cookies. Subheading, I've been thrown out of better rooms than this and just earlier today. Excuse me, but what's the worst thing that can happen to you in anyone's office? I realize that on soaps and some series, people are defenestrated, seduced, and or threatened. But that's not the real world. Stop worrying about what's going to happen to you when you walk through the real or metaphorical door. The one thing I will guarantee, really, I'll give you 1,000 to 1, is that you're going to be walking out again. If you're carried in, all bets are off. So the focus needs to be on what transpires between your entrance and your exit. Here are some hints for handling strange environments and unfamiliar surroundings. First, take a few moments to take it in. Look around. Don't leap into the middle of a conversation as if it's a rugby scrum. One of my favorite techniques is to stick my head in ahead of time. Sometimes the secretary will offer you a seat in the other person's office to wait, or sometimes the empty office door is open and I take a look. I want to familiarize myself with what is otherwise unfamiliar. This is an old professional speaking trick, by the way, wherein you walk on stage in a deserted room prior to the event so you can get a feel for the place. Number two, think about being on neutral ground. Conference rooms are usually sufficiently universal and banal so you don't have any surprises, or meet in a restaurant, particularly one that you know, or invite the other person to your club. This last alternative is somewhat difficult if you don't have a club. Number three, after you absorb the environment, focus on the other person. Don't miss early body language or statements. If you ignore the foundation, the barn's going to collapse. Number four, set the agenda. Simply state, I know your time is tight, as is mine. I have 3 issues I'd like to discuss, and I imagine you have a few. Why don't we list them, set some priorities, and then invest our time accordingly? That immediately establishes you as a peer. Both of our time is tight. And allows you to actually create the music to dance to. Number five, search for patterns indicating behavior. In other words, is the office carefully organized or cluttered? Does the other person allow for interruptions or turn others away? Are you offered refreshments or not? Do you face each other across a desk or do you sit on comfortable couches? Does the other person ask about you and your background or dive into the business at hand immediately? Number six, is there anything you recognize that will further the relationship? A photo, a memento, an award, a piece of art, the view, the furniture, whatever. We are all at a bit of a disadvantage on someone else's turf, but that needn't be permanent or fatal. After a while, the unfamiliar becomes the familiar, and after a while, you realize there's nothing you haven't seen and experienced before. I always think back to actual places I've been tossed out of. The original Le Cirque restaurant, because I didn't have a tie, even though there was a guy without a jacket or tie seated not far behind the super arrogant maitre d', the no good, who's long gone, bless his black heart. The inside of a cross-channel steamer, because my friends and I could only afford the cheapest tickets, and the crew made it a point of honor to keep us out of the on the cold decks in the dark of night, heading from England to France. I was thrown out of Kensington Park in London because a delightful young woman and I had not noticed that night had fallen and the park was closed. A private club in Summit, New Jersey, because my wife's and my backgrounds were not sufficiently consistent with the existing members, and to be more accurate, they actually never even allowed us in at all, the snobs. And a high rollers room in a Vegas casino where I had moseyed up to a table, placed a $25 bet, and was shown a sign, and subsequently the door, that said $2,500 minimum bet. I've been thrown out of a lot of places. We all get thrown out of places, most of which we shouldn't really want to be in. But you can limit the chances of this by understanding the environment, seeking out associational clues, and acting as if you belong there. Subhead, the care and feeding of the bruised ego. In coaching, counseling, and mentoring thousands of people globally, I've encountered few factors which cause more angst, fear, and vacillation than fretful egos. I'm not talking about the giant ego that devours all in its path like the zipped-up Japanese monsters crushing Tokyo with regularity in the horror films of the 50s. At least, these are easily identifiable. You can run from them, and sooner or later, someone discovers a death ray or sonic boom that dissolves them into the likes of whining, splattered puddles of non-toxic goo. Rather, I'm referring to the stately, modest, quite proper egos, which are threatened by someone pointing out that they're using the wrong fork to eat the soup. Quote, Alan, we're seeking success, not perfection, unquote, said one of my therapists 15 years or more ago for $110 an hour. This is why, by the way, I never give any service provider or vendor any of my books and generally suggest that they're really not relevant. The readily bruised ego rules the psychic playing field under these conditions. One, you crave perfection to avoid being critiqued in any way. Two, you take critique as personal rejection and or attacks on your self-worth. Admit it. Have you been forced to breathe the exhaust of this toxic tandem? The irony of people not budging or refusing to disclose or avoiding all risk because of a metaphorical bruise which will occur completely unseen to others and cause no physical impairment is astounding but devastating. There's an underlying lack of self-worth which peels the layers off the ego and leaves it, like a shucked clam, vulnerable to all sorts of unpleasant contingencies, such as voracious seagulls. Here's an example of the difference in relationship between efficacy, the competency to achieve results, and self-worth, how you value yourself. We commented earlier that you can be good at something but not feel you deserve it, or you can feel good about yourself but not feel your talents are being sufficiently applied and acknowledged. Albert Bandura, who's been sort of the rock star of behavioral psychology in some circles, highlights the fact that one's abilities and one's beliefs in self are independent variables. Try Albert Bandura's book, by the way, Self-Efficacy, from Macmillan, 1997. I'd add to this that people who have high efficacy but low self-worth feel that they're an imposter, whereby they don't feel they deserve to be where they are, and hence someday they'll be found out or outed. They feel lucky to get away with their current status for the time being, and that status often lasts for 25 years. We need to tuck our egos away, because when they're so exposed and perched on the surface, they're vulnerable to every shrug and moan from passing pedestrians. We also need to bury our egos in deep bunkers so that we know they're safe and even a direct hit isn't going to cause any damage. So if you have high efficacy, you're good at things, and high self-worth, you're engaged and satisfied. If you have high efficacy but low self-worth, you're going to be engaged in protest and grievance. Your talents aren't being used. If you have high self-worth, but low efficacy, you'll have self-devaluation and despondency because you won't feel very good about things. And if you're both low in expectation and efficacy, you're going to be resigned and apathetic. You know, a woman was a guest speaker at an event for which I was the MC. In an obviously memorized and scripted speech, she made a couple of errors that a professional would catch, but an audience probably wouldn't. She ended 10 minutes early, not a cardinal sin, was escorted off the stage by me with very nice applause from the audience. Backstage, she said to me, how was it? I said, fine. And she burst into tears. Now, I've driven quite a few people to real and symbolic tears, but never with merely fine. What's wrong? I shouted above the sobbing. Fine isn't good enough, she wailed. I have to be great. Now, isn't that a nice burden to walk around with? So how do we do this? How do we act so that we have high self-worth at all times, even if we're good at some things and not others? Well, first, act like the mafia. That's right, it's never personal. It's only about business. An Australian or New Yorker will both tell you, with equally strange accents, that you're wrong, misguided, and foolish, and then offer to buy you a beer. Don't take it personally. And remember, it's up to you to determine if they're right or if they already had too much to drink. Treat questions and objections as signs of interest. The worst and most dangerous people are those who are apathetic, since they offer no sign of acceptance or rejection, and you never know how they feel. But people who object or merely question are exhibiting signs of interest. Don't treat them like plague carriers. Separate the factual from the ad hominem. If someone is using observed behavior and evidence, then listen. For example, you never established eye contact, or there are typos in the slides, or you have celery protruding from your incisors. However, ignore or even rebut the judgmental. You're not a team player, or clothing selection is beyond your abilities, or you're arrogant. I'm always spending time ignoring this last one. Seriously, it's the rebuttal of people who don't know how to argue with you on an intellectual basis, so they resort to psychological warfare. You're old, you're arrogant. Don't bother with judgmental accusations, but do get the celery out of your teeth. Look at the gestalt and never generalize from a specific. One instance, one example, one situation does not symbolize or encapsulate your worth. View your life, your history, your probable future. A single victory or a single defeat does not define you, and those who allow either to do so often become clinically depressed. And that's the danger when you trot over those hot coals. The feeling doesn't last. View your entire presence, and you're much more unlikely to allow a single episode to damage your self-worth. A strong, resilient, and protracted ego is at the heart of thriving. It's a Golconda that's constantly renewing and rewarding. Subhead, Churchillian logic. Easy for me to say. Churchillian logic. It's courage that counts. Perhaps the best source of British quotes since Oscar Wilde is Winston Churchill. By the way, a note of dumbing down of our times. In a prior book, I cited Oscar Wilde twice. The permissions editor at the publisher told me that she would not allow the book to go into production until I had signed permission from Oscar Wilde to use his quotes. You can't make this stuff up. When I told the editor-in-chief, I thought he was going to have a heart attack. Winston Churchill, anyway, observed that success is never final and failure seldom fatal. It's courage that counts. Ironically, you need just a modicum of courage to succeed these days. In most cases, simply holding your ground will put you ahead of the pack, since the pack retreats like sandpipers before the incoming tide at the merest hint of turbulence. The Aztec warriors were renowned for tethering their ankles to a stake in the ground, hence the bromide today to put a stake in the ground, and fighting on that spot without the possibility of retreat. This sounds heroic and mighty, except they couldn't advance either, at least not very easily. Overcoming the fear of failure means being willing to fail. The best race car drivers have been in collisions, the best golfers have hit the ball in the water, the best actors have gone up on their lines, and the best entrepreneurs have been broke. If you allow setbacks to become terminal failures, then you have no hope, no recourse, no tomorrow. Resilient people do not regard failure as a personal statement about either their worth or their efficacy. And herein is the secret. If your learning philosophy is internally focused, you'll act as if you have learned everything necessary to succeed. However, when the inevitable setback slams you, you'll have nothing left. You will have shot your bolt, to use another ancient military bromide, and there's nothing left. After all, if you know all you need to know, and it wasn't enough, then what else is there? People who conscientiously regard their learning as internally focused become depressed easily and don't bounce back from setback. They show little resilience. This could be subconscious as well as conscious. They're often easily thrown and don't recover. Once off the horse, even though otherwise able to ride again, they choose not to remount. If your learning philosophy is externally focused, you'll act as though you need to access other sources to continue to succeed. When the inevitable setback undermines you, you'll seek out the additional learning and skills to overcome it and prevent it next time. If there is all that learning out there, then there is no limit to what you can integrate and apply in any conditions. People who regard their learning as externally focused are resilient. They never take setbacks personally. They don't generalize from negative specifics. And they resemble the weeble that wobbles but doesn't fall down. Once off the horse, they bounce up and get back on, sometimes so quickly the horse hasn't even had a chance to slow up. Instead of empty phrases, we all need clear beliefs and pragmatic skills to thrive. Telling yourself that they can't knock you down is inherently false, since we all get knocked down sooner or later. But believing that setbacks are learning experiences and not commentaries on our worth, and searching out and applying new skills to overcome the deficiency or the challenge, are what create healthy and prosperous adults, and for that matter, children and teens. We fear things and situations that can't really hurt us. Public speaking, crowds, heights, social conversation, powerful people in our presence, entertaining, shopping, writing, and so on. I've met people and counseled people with all these quote-unquote afflictions and more. The fear is irrational because it's not based on observable behavior or evidence. As just one example, about 95% of all the people attending a speech or training program of any kind wanted to succeed. The other 5% are distracted by personal issues, a spat with their significant other, a traffic jam, money problems, or they have behavioral disorders, which tend to relish in shady, easy for me to say, schadenfreude. The speaker generally has the support of the audience, not its antipathy, enmity, or skepticism. No healthy human wants to go home and say, "Hey, what a great day I had. I wasted 2 hours of my time. I watched the speaker go down in flames. It was totally useless." The fear isn't of the actual, it's of the invented. So are some of the remedies. Imagining the audience is naked is one of the dumbest, most moronic techniques I can think of, and of course, one of the most recommended. We owe ourselves the personal dignity of overcoming fantasy causes and fantasy cures, such as trotting over hot coals and thinking it proves anything other than the power of perspiration of the feet, not exactly a key job aid. That's the kind of courage I'm talking about in order to thrive. What do I need to do to overcome my basically unfounded and silly fears? Being afraid of the dark as a child is no different from being afraid of mice or public speaking as an adult. The fear is a vast overreaction to the contextual situation, although at least you can excuse the child who has integrated far less learning than the adult. Superstitions are merely attempts to organize fears without having to understand them. It's easier to remember not to put your hat on a table or open an umbrella indoors than to deal with whatever causes such hysteria. It's courage that counts, the courage to face fears logically and rationally, using formal or informal help if you need it. It's the courage to understand the power of an external locus of learning. And it's the courage to say, "I'm not here to merely get by and survive, I'm here to thrive." We're not here to stick our toe in the water, folks. We're here to make waves. And that's the end of chapter 4.